Spanning nearly 2 million square feet in the largest recorded storm in history, Hurricane Sandy spared few in her path, from small Haitian villages to the big city of Manhattan. Catherine Miles has now written the new book Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy, a book written to coincide with the second anniversary of this massive, unprecedented storm. The book is a work of investigative journalism that is the first ever complete moment-by-moment account of the superstorm. Again, the book is entitled Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Catherine Miles to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Hi, it's my pleasure. I'm so glad to be here.
Very nice to have you here. So as we look at the two-year mark of the storm, it's incredible to see how much we are still dealing with the storm.
That's right. It's still a very contemporary issue for a lot of people, both in terms of meteorology, in terms of rebuilding. And so even though the storm occurred 2 years ago, it's in the news every single day, and with good reason.
And much of the reason that it's in the news is rebuilding, and the concerns, of course, is something like this could happen again.
That's right. Sandy was not a traditional hurricane in many senses, and that's revealed a lot of holes and gaps that we have, both in terms of forecasting, in terms of insurance payments, in terms of even legal processes. And so we're all still really scratching our heads.
How did we come to that term superstorm? How did that evolve over the time that we watched this go from a hurricane to the superstorm that we saw bang into the Northeast?
I think it was really just sort of an attempt to put a label on this massive, bizarre system as it was happening. The true meteorological term for it is an ex-tropical cyclone. That's what a meteorologist would tell you Sandy was. That doesn't really convey a lot to the American public. And so we scrambled. Frankenstorm for a while, superstorm, megastorm, hybrid storm. Right. We were really at a loss to come up with a word to describe just how big and bad the storm was.
Do we assume that we know what's going to happen when a storm comes up the coast, in the sense of we look back at history and we try to predict what will happen, and that is what we base our efforts on? And then when something like this comes up that has never happened before, at least in recent memory, we're not quite sure what to do.
That's exactly right, and we have a variety of factors happening here. We have a lot of, I think, disbelief, or if you wanted to be more negative, we could say apathy on the part of the American public. We just don't believe this can happen to us because it hasn't. We have a lot of historical precedent that suggests that storms behave in certain ways, and we're finding that that's not true anymore. As we have warming seas and rising sea levels, we're having to throw out all of our existing maps and data and try to recreate on the fly as it's happening.
Perhaps blame is too strong a word, but you certainly make a point in the book to say that pretty much at every level, whether it's top government officials or the average citizen in a town in Vermont or on the coast of Manhattan, was unprepared.
That's right. And that's really where this is a national story and not a regional story. I think it shows the holes we have in infrastructure in terms of forecasting and just how vulnerable an underfunded forecasting system is. It also shows a lot about how we deal with risk management, both on the federal and local level and also on the individual level. And taken in its sum total, when something like Sandy comes, we have this domino effect where lives are lost really quite needlessly.
You write the book as a moment-by-moment account, and each chapter is a different day. For you, where was the real turning point, where this went from a traditional storm, if you will, to something quite extraordinary?
There are a couple of moments. One of the most harrowing is the series of conversations that occurred with the National Weather Service right around October 25th and October 26th. When they realized that the storm was going to collide with a nor'easter and become something other than a hurricane, they realized really quickly that the National Hurricane Center literally could not issue watches and warnings or advisories. And so they were left with what one official told me were three really lousy options. They couldn't necessarily forecast the storm if it changed. Some people wanted to forecast the storm and continue to call it a hurricane, even though it wasn't. That came up with some serious sort of credibility issues. And then there was the other option that they ultimately went with, which was to hand over responsibility of the forecasting and advisory to these small National Weather Service offices who did, you know, a Herculean job, but were not prepared and not ready to take on the challenge necessarily of this national forecasting.
With 2020 hindsight, I ask the question, if we had had better forecasting, if we had had better planning, how would things have been different? Because the storm still would have been the storm.
And we should say the forecasting was really quite good. In terms of error rates, the forecasting for Sandy was better than it was for a lot of hurricanes. The problem, I think, was disseminating those forecasts to the American public. The message got garbled. It got garbled at a couple of different levels. People were confused. People thought, this can't possibly be right. The weatherman is always wrong. And so it really was sort of an issue more of social science in some ways, I think, than it was of science.
And talk a little bit about that social science and what you do about that in the future.
We have this weird system here in the United States that's different than a lot of other countries. We have a federal governmental agency that creates the forecasts and the watches and the warnings. But their responsibility really ends there. They're sort of a passive agency by design. They create these in the hopes that private news agencies will disseminate the information to the public. And you start to see a lot of sort of cross-messaging and mis-messaging where some agencies will take the forecast verbatim and some will have their own in-house meteorologist kind of tweak or change them. So the message gets garbled, and that's what we saw in Sandy. That's what we see in other hurricanes as well. So there needs to be a lot of education on both levels in terms of letting scientists convey information in a way that makes sense to the American public and also making sure that the American public knows how to receive that information.
So we go from scientists to politicians. You write in the book that New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and other officials in the area had access to data and called for evacuations in low-lying areas. And it took the mayor of New York City 36 hours after that to do the same. You write about that. What went into the mayor's decision?
Well, there was really a lot of confusion happening in New York City, and I don't think New York has really fully sorted it out yet. I got a lot of mixed messages when I asked this question. But what we do know for sure is that New York City was operating under the assumption that the flood levels were going to be no worse than Hurricane Irene. That obviously was very incorrect. The Mayor Bloomberg, went on the news the Saturday before the storm hit, so less than 48 hours, and told New Yorkers it was going to be fine, no problem, no need to leave. That created this huge firestorm, both in the industry and in the media, where all of these meteorologists, both private and federal, were saying, oh my God, he's made some terrible error. Flurry of phone calls and attempts at intervention to try to get New York up to speed. They had obviously made some kind of catastrophic mistake. There's a lot of finger-pointing going on right now about why that mistake was made, and we may never get to the bottom of it. But the important thing is that it left millions of New Yorkers at risk, and some of them probably lost their lives as a result.
You talk about at a risk, and this was something that you know, even though it happened 2 years ago, I knew but had forgotten, and that was more than 7 million Americans lost power as a result of Sandy, which really brings this into focus of preparedness and this being a huge impact of the storm is the loss of power.
That's right. This is an infrastructure story. And really what Sandy did was highlight the multiple places where we have an infrastructure crisis. One of them is the grid. Mass transportation is another one. I would argue that the entire field of meteorology is a third one.
And that entire field of meteorology, so what do they do to get their act together?
Well, they have their act together, but they're underfunded and unsupported. And that's a really important distinction, I think. That, you know, the meteorologists who are doing the heavy lifting are phenomenal people and phenomenal scientists, but they are dealing with a grossly underfunded agency. NOAA exists in the Department of Commerce. It's been largely neglected, I think, by Congress and by the American people. And so they're dealing with failing satellites. They're dealing with radar that breaks on a regular basis. They have understaffed offices. They have overworked meteorologists. The country has one storm surge expert for the entire country. Storm surge is the most deadly part of a hurricane. We're relying on one very talented and hardworking guy to do this for all of us. And, you know, the math just doesn't compute there.
You used a word that I wanted to get back to, and that is apathy. I think it's an interesting word because there is so much coverage, and far be it for me to put a spotlight or to blame the media, which is not my intention in this question. However, I think a case can be made that so much is said about so many different storms going up the coast that there does reach an hysteria level that people have a difficult time in really ascertaining what is a true disaster headed their way. And because so many times what has promised to be a horrible disaster has ended up being little to nothing.
That's right. And, you know, we have several things that are happening here. You know, disaster self, that's just that we love disaster stories as a culture. And so, you know, when they happen, especially when natural disaster and weather disaster happens, they're always the top story. And sometimes that's very warranted. But, you know, in the quest for ratings, I think that sometimes some media outlets make decisions to perhaps overhype or sensationalize storms or things like the polar vortex, which, you know, it's just sort of a naturally occurring phenomenon, but when you tweak it a little, it sounds like you know, something very bad like Armageddon is going to happen to all of us.
Right.
So the American public gets confused, or like you said, a series of sensational stories occur. You know, they say, look, this is going to be really bad. It's not. So people assume, well, this is a cry wolf scenario. I don't need to actually evacuate when I'm told.
So who is left holding the bag in making it real? Because it seems as if, as evidenced by the story we told about the mayor of New York City and even school officials who are saying, should we close schools today? Should we not close schools today? And trying to make an educated decision and getting a lot of different information from a lot of different people.
And it's a hard decision. And we should say that, too. I mean, there's a lot at stake with an evacuation. Millions of dollars will be lost if a city relies on tourism, it relies on trade. You know, that's going to be dollars lost that may be very detrimental. Moving someone who has special needs, someone who's in a nursing home or a hospital, comes with tremendous risk. You know, moving a family, frankly, comes with risk as well. So it is a very difficult decision to make. I think the question we have to ask is, you know, how great of a risk is too great? It's a gamble. It's a game of probability and rolling the dice. In general, we assume that it's going to take something really big to warrant evacuation. And I think we really need to rethink that. I think we need to really accept that our lives are constantly on the line, and we need to make decisions with that in mind.
Because there does seem to be a damned if you do, damned if you don't air to this.
And that happened with Irene. You know, a lot of people,
right,
for instance, on Long Island, Staten Island, ordered to evacuate, went inland. Their homes on the coast were completely untouched. They were trapped inland by floodwaters. And they thought, well, why do you want me to do that again? It didn't work the first time. Why would it work the second time?
So in reading the book and doing this research over the past 2 years, what do you want our takeaway to be?
I think it really has to be about risk assessment. We really need to think through, what is an acceptable risk? What is acceptable for us in terms of the standards we want to insist on for meteorology? I, for one, would like to see a lot more money given to organizations like NOAA, like the Hurricane Hunters, the people who are on the front lines keeping the rest of us safe. I think we also really need to be willing to alter our lives to keep us safe, whether it's lifestyle choices, where we live, the willingness to leave when a storm is coming.
The name of the book is Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy. It is published by Dutton. Catherine Miles, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I do appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Catherine Miles is the author of Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.